Sometimes in your search for happiness, you ponder the meaning of your life.
And what is the truth?
You sift your memory for beginnings.
The truth.
You send your mind ahead for directions.
Truth.
But all you really know is now, and you are lost in the present.
And what is the truth?
Well, now, here's a man who wants to get right down to it. Kind of anxious to get to it, are you? Whatever.
Welcome back to the History of Being Human podcast. I'm the host, Noel Armstrong. On the evening of July 31st, 1966, Charles Whitman and his wife, Kathy, were out visiting friends. They returned home around 6 so that Kathy could get to work. After Kathy left for her shift, Charles Whitman sat down at a typewriter around 6:30 at night and typed out these words. Quote, "I do not quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed. I do not really understand myself these days. I'm supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts." End quote. Over the next 24 hours, Charles would kill his mother, then his wife, and then, carrying several firearms and over 700 rounds of ammunition, make his way up to the 27th floor, the observation deck of the clock tower at the University of Texas at Austin. There he would gun down 44 strangers, killing 13 of them. The final victim of his shooting would die 25 years later, but his death would also be ruled a homicide because he would end up dying from kidney damage inflicted on him at the time of Charles Whitman's shooting. In total, then, 16 people dead and an additional 30 people wounded at the hands of this one man, Charles Whitman. It was the deadliest mass shooting in America until that time, and it would change the way that life was lived in the United States forever afterward. In the aftermath, investigators found in Charles Whitman a very unlikely villain. He was an altar boy in the Roman Catholic Church, a newspaper delivery boy, a pitcher for his parochial school's baseball team, manager of the school's football team. At 12 years and 3 months old, he became one of the youngest Eagle Scouts on record. He grew up in Lake Charles, Florida, with two brothers and a mother and father. His father was a moderately successful plumber. And in 1959, at 18 years old, Charlie joined the Marines. He was later discharged honorably, and then he went to the University of Texas, where he was a B student. And so in the broad outline of Charlie's life, it's hard to figure out what it was that made him snap. Why did he do what he did? Well, the investigation and the autopsy turned up two interesting facts. One was that in the months leading up to his murder spree, he'd been complaining of severe headaches and intrusive thoughts. The autopsy showed a tumor near his amygdala, a brain tumor, about the size of a pecan, in an area that might be relevant to mood stability and impulse control and threat management. Now, as you know, the History of Being Human podcast is not really a true crime podcast, unless, of course, you mean crime and psychopathy on the world historical scale, and then I think we have brought you our fair share of these episodes. So why am I devoting an entire episode to one murderer, Charles Whitman? Well, the reason for this is that his case has been frequently referenced regarding one of the biggest big-picture topics in history, one of the greatest mysteries and debates of philosophy, cognitive neuroscience, and theology. I'm speaking of the free will debate. Do we have free will? Can we choose freely what we will do or what we won't do? Or is our belief that our choices are free a mere illusion? Well, it turns out that Charles Whitman, the killer on the clock tower, has been press-ganged into being the poster child for hard psychophysical determinism. By that, I mean the position that our free will is an illusion. All of our actions are determined by pre-existing factors either in our brain or the physical world. One example of this will be from Sam Harris, who's argued that free will is totally illusory, a sort of non-explanation we employ simply because we don't understand all of the underpinnings of our behavior yet. According to Harris, if we could see all of the determinants of our behavior, we would realize that our behavior is determined. We are not free. Free will is illusory. This is what Harris says about Charles Whitman. In a talk given in Vancouver on free will, he says, quote, "Consider Charles Whitman. In 1966, he started his spree by killing his wife and mother, and then he got on the clock tower at the University of Texas armed with several guns and 700 rounds of ammunition and shot people for 2 hours until he was killed by the police. In his suicide note, he confessed that he found his behavior completely inexplicable. He loved his mother and wife, didn't know why he was doing any of this. He had been overwhelmed by rage for months, and recommended upon his death that his brain be autopsied. And so they found a tumor in the hypothalamus pressing on his amygdala. So this changes things. When you find out that this evil murderer has a brain tumor pressing on his amygdala, he suddenly seems like a victim of biology." End quote. And according to Michael Koenigs, assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin School of Public Health, quote, "The tumor in Whitman's amygdala could have tweaked his personality. It could certainly have affected his emotional state, and it could certainly affect his body's physiologic responses to threat," end quote. Of course, there are many others who disagree with the idea that Whitman's murder spree was caused by a tumor. It was Whitman and not his tumor who shot those people, they would say, and they present arguments to back their position. So the case of Charles Whitman is useful in calling attention to the issues around the question of free will. And free will is one of the most intractable questions about the history of our species. It's one of the most hotly argued also. And the reason for that is, of course, the stakes are pretty high. As the case of Charles Whitman illustrates, how much of what we do depends on our free choices, choices that we make freely? How much does our nature determine what we do? By that I mean our biology, genes, neuroanatomy, hormones, physiology. How much of it comes from more intangible factors like character and goodwill? And what does that mean for our moral agency? If actions are truly determined by factors beyond our control, how can we be responsible? Can any action be said to be blameworthy? Or can any act of selflessness or heroism be said to be praiseworthy? And I'll admit at the outset, I'm not here to attempt to answer any of those questions. But I do want to raise the questions. I want to bring them to your attention through the case of Charles Whitman, the shooter on the tower. If you're looking for clues into why Charles Whitman became a mass killer, you won't find many of them in his childhood, even in hindsight. You know, in the biography of many famous killers, you can find evidence of some early budding psychopathy. But not really with Charles Whitman. He wasn't obsessed with death or violence. He didn't torture animals. By all accounts, he wasn't a terrible bully, nor was he bullied. And yes, there were problems in the Whitman home, as anybody who has studied his life could tell you. But those problems weren't significantly worse than what was going on in a lot of homes, homes where the children didn't grow up to become mass murderers. So with that necessary proviso in mind, we'll talk about Charles Whitman's entire life, beginning with his birth. He was born in June of 1941, the oldest child of Charles and Margaret Whitman. Charles Whitman Sr., as we already discussed, was a plumbing contractor. He was moderately successful. They lived in a large ranch-style home in Lake Charles, Florida. Charlie Jr., as he was known, was, by all accounts, just the all-American, tow-headed, little mischievous boy, according to one neighbor. This is Mrs. L.J. Holleran, who lived next door. Quote, "Charles was high-spirited and a lot of fun as a child, but he gave no trouble," end quote. Charlie had two little brothers. One was named Patrick, the other John. So he was the oldest of three boys. And if you can't tell by the names Patrick and John, the family was Roman Catholic. Charlie was actually an altar boy, which was a source of great pride to his mother, who was quite devout. He also was an Eagle Scout. As I mentioned, he was one of the youngest Eagle Scouts at 12 years and 3 months in the country. That takes a lot of hard work to become an Eagle Scout at 12 years and 3 months. You have to put your nose to the grindstone and just go through the whole thing. But that's what Charlie did, partially at the insistence of his father, Charles Sr. According to all accounts, Charles Sr. was a very strict, stern, and demanding father figure. but we'll get back to that. As Charlie grew up, he had a paper route. He delivered the Palm Beach Post, and if it rained, his mother, Margaret, would drive him around and help him deliver the papers. And that's something that comes up again and again. Even though the parents were strict, they did try to give their sons plenty of advantages, plenty of assistance. In fact, according to his very strict father, Charles Sr., Charles Sr. was a self-made man, very proud of it, but he indulged his boys. He said, quote, "I was raised as an orphan," this is Charles Sr., "and didn't have the advantages my boys did. So I gave them everything I could, cars when they were just kids, that kind of thing," end quote. So it doesn't seem that little Charlie Jr. was raised in any kind of condition of deprivation. Yes, he had to work, and at times he would work hard to achieve, but in ways that were well within the bounds of social norms. But there was one aspect of little Charlie Jr.'s upbringing and of the family life of the entire Whitman family that was well outside the accepted norms. That was, Charles Sr., the father, had a very bad temper. According to Charles Sr., quote, "I was a strict father. With all three of my sons, it was yes, sir, and no, sir. They minded me. My wife minded me, too. I did on many occasions beat my wife. I have to admit it, because of my temper, I knocked her around. But my wife was a fine woman, and she understood my nature," end quote. So according to Charles Sr.'s assessment, being a fine woman meant understanding why your husband knocked you around from time to time. So that was not a normal part of Charlie Jr.'s family life. He saw this happen, and it certainly did have effects on him. And while Charlie might have hated that part of his father's temperament, there were other things about his father that he not only loved, but he wanted to emulate. One of those was the love for guns in the family. Charles Sr. was a gun nut, self-confessed fanatic for guns. Guns were hanging in almost every room in Charlie Jr.'s house. Charlie's training in the use of guns began as soon as he was strong enough to hold them. He was, according to his father, quote, "always a crack shot, and by the time he graduated from Cardinal Newman High School, he could plug a squirrel in the eye at 50 yards," end quote. So I may need to revise my earlier claim that Charlie didn't torture animals when he was a kid. And it's true that we have no indication he took pleasure in the pain of animals, but he did enjoy shooting them. It was a recreational activity approved by Charles Sr. for all three boys. As Charlie matured, he was certainly not the loser loner type. He was fairly strong, well-muscled, good-looking kid. He was the pitcher for the high school baseball team, manager for the football team, as we already said, and involved in various other extracurricular activities. He was actually pretty smart also. Apparently, he took an IQ test sometime when he was a kid, got a score of 138, which I admit might sound impressive, but if you share my opinion of these unofficial IQ tests, you know that that score of 138 plus chicken poop would make fertilizer. Nevertheless, he was apparently a fairly intelligent kid. He got B's in class. He described himself as a B student. The next event of significance in Charlie's life that we know about is that on 6 July 1959, just 12 days after his 18th birthday, he enlisted in the Marines. By all accounts, he wanted out of his house, away from his father. When his father heard about it, in fact, he was not happy that Charlie enlisted in the Marines. He tried to call somebody at Marine Recruiting and have the enlistment canceled, but was unsuccessful, so Charlie did indeed join the Marines. At the time Charlie joined the Marines, he was 6 feet tall and weighed 200 pounds. So he was a solid kid. And once he was in the Marines, his rifle skills really paid off. On the range, he earned a score of 215 points out of a possible 250. This meant that Charlie earned the designation of sharpshooter. That's the second highest designation. The only higher rating would have been expert, so he was an excellent shot. Because of his success in the Marines, he qualified for a Navy scientific training program at the University of Texas in Austin. This was a really good opportunity for him. He would have gotten an officer's commission and the equivalent of a bachelor's degree, so he could have become an officer in the Marine Corps. And so at 20 years old, in September of 1961, he was well on his way. He began his studies at UT Austin. Soon he began dating a fellow student named Kathleen Leisner. According to one of their close friends, they seemed like the perfect couple. Kathleen was studying to become a school teacher. Charlie was becoming an Army officer. She was a couple years younger than he was, and they seemed to be totally in love. They got married in the summer of 1962. And while I'm not Charlie Whitman, so I'm not qualified to say this, you might make the case that this was the high point of Charles Whitman's life. He was married to the girl he was in love with. He was going to become an officer in the Marine Corps, going to school. She was going to be a school teacher. Everything seemed to be going swimmingly for them. Unfortunately, though, Charlie could not maintain it. Several setbacks followed. The first of these major setbacks came in February of 1963. They hadn't even been married for 1 year, and Charlie was forced to quit the University of Texas because of unsatisfactory academic progress. This was a bitter pill for Charlie by all accounts. He found it hard to readjust to life as an enlisted Marine at Camp Lejeune in South Carolina. Gone was the promise of a speedy rise through the ranks as an officer. But something was changing in Charlie, because what followed was a string of violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice through the summer and early autumn of 1963. He was court-martialed in November of 1963. The charges for which he was court-martialed, having an unauthorized 25 caliber pistol with him aboard the USS Raleigh and at Camp Lejeune, along with two rounds of 7.62mm ammunition that he wasn't supposed to be carrying with him, and get this, 10 instances of lending money for interest and gambling with a member of his unit. In addition, he was charged with, quote, communicating a threat to another Marine to knock his teeth out, end quote. But he denied that charge. He said, I'm not guilty of that. After the evidence, the court found him guilty of threatening that Marine also. So Charlie was beginning to change, or maybe some of his nature was beginning to show. Things were just deteriorating, going from bad to worse. First, he'd been drummed out of UT Austin, so he's no longer in officer training. But after his court-martial, he was busted from corporal down to private and given 30 days hard labor. Somehow, though, Charlie held it together. He lasted another year plus in the Marines. He was discharged honorably in December of 1964. So 1963 was a pretty bad year for Charlie Whitman. February of 1963, he has to quit the University of Texas because of poor performance. By November of 1963, he's court-martialed, busted down to private. By the end of 1964, he is discharged honorably, this time as private first class. He decides to enroll once again at the University of Texas in Austin, this time in their mechanical engineering program. Now, this was a risky move by Charlie. He'd already failed once at the University of Texas, Austin. He was now going to take another swing at it. His wife, Kathy, by this time had graduated. She was teaching at Lanier High School in Austin. They had to live on a very modest budget, so they rented a very small cottage on what was called Jewel Street. And it's interesting, children from the area at the time remember Charlie. They remember he hung a rope from a pecan tree in his yard, and there he would do his Marine Corps exercises while they all stood around and watched and clapped for him. Fact is that during this time, Charlie took a lot of pride in his physique and staying healthy. But he was also a total jerk. It's fine if you want to be healthy, but in front of friends even, he criticized his wife Kathy about her thighs. So Charlie was a chip off the old block in many ways, it sounds like. School was anything but easy for Charlie at this time also. He had to change from mechanical engineering to architectural engineering, ostensibly because he could, quote, express his artistic talents better, end quote, which I believe is code word for, I can't get through DiffEQ. I can't handle these differential equations, so I need to change my major. Studying did not come naturally or easily for Charlie. According to friends who knew him at the time, he would pretty much kill himself to maintain a B average in his coursework. According to his friend Frank Greenhawk, quote, Charlie would stay up studying all night long in the engineering building, sometimes putting his head on the drafting table for a nap, and in the morning, Kathy would come up with his breakfast, end quote. So Charlie was killing himself. He was working very hard to try to make the grade. In this way, Charlie got through his coursework through 1965. Then, in the spring of 1966, he had another piece of news. His mother, Margaret Whitman, called him from Lake Worth, Florida, and told Charlie that she had had enough. She was going to leave his father. She was sick of getting beaten, sick of being abused, and she was leaving. Charlie drove down to Lake Worth from the University of Texas at Austin to help her pack her things and leave. Because he knew his father's proclivities toward violence, he actually had a police car sitting outside the family home while he packed his mother's bags for her. It was a natural decision for Margaret to move near Charles Jr., her oldest son. The youngest son, John, had been arrested for throwing a rock through a window. He was living on his own. After he'd been arrested, he was offered either a $25 fine or he could choose to move back in with his father. John chose to pay the $25 fine. He didn't want to move back in with the father. At 17 years old, he was also done with Charles Sr. The only son living at the home was Patrick. And the reason he was living there is because he was employed by Charles Sr.'s plumbing company. So family problems were actually affecting Charlie deeply. March 29, 1966, he visited Dr. Maurice Heatley, the University of Texas staff psychiatrist. Charlie not only confessed to hating his father in some ways, but also emulating his father in some ways. he confessed that he had actually hit his own wife, Kathy, a few times. He told this University of Texas psychiatrist, Dr. Heatley, that he was making Herculean efforts, what he described as intense efforts, to control his temper. But he was worried at times that he was just going to snap, to explode. He felt out of control at times. During the interview with Charles Whitman, Dr. Heatley described him as, quote, a massive, muscular youth who, quote, seemed to be oozing with hostility, end quote. And this part is sad to report. During the entire two-hour interview, only one direct quote from Charlie Whitman was written down word for word by Dr. Heatley. And that is this, quote, I'm thinking about going up on the tower with a deer rifle and starting shooting people, end quote. That wasn't very upsetting to Dr. Heatley at the time. It was, he said, quote, a common experience for students who came to the clinic to think of the tower as the site for some desperate action, end quote. So apparently when students came to the psych clinic, they talked about jumping off the tower or shooting from the tower or going naked around the tower or something like that. So it wasn't altogether out of the ordinary for somebody to say something like that to Dr. Heatley. And you have to also remember that living at that time, there wasn't much precedent for this. Currently in our day and age, of course, Dr. Heatley would have called the FBI or the police or whoever it was, but at that time, it seemed like some idle but very frustrated musings. When you look at Charlie's home and family and school situation, you can see that the pressures were beginning to mount. He only had about a year left to get his degree in architectural engineering, and during that summer semester of 1966, he registered for a very heavy course load, so he had school pressure weighing on him. He had moved his mother into a home very close to where he and Kathy lived, and he was being subjected to harassing phone calls from his father repeatedly during that summer. According to the testimony from Charlie Sr., Charles' father, he had subjected him to a torrent of phone calls. He said, quote, I'm not ashamed of the fact that I spent $1,000 a month on the phone bill, begging my wife to come back. I love my wife dearly, my sons dearly, and I wanted our home to be happy. I kept begging Charlie to come back to me too. I promised Charlie that if he'd only persuade his mama to come back, I'd swear never to lay a hand on her, end quote, said every serial abuser ever, pretty much. And Charlie's mother, Margaret, wasn't having any of it. So Charles hated his father, Charles Sr., and yet he saw himself doing the same things to his own wife, Kathy, much to his shame and chagrin. To his friends, to people who knew him, he started to complain that things were getting out of hand. He was starting to experience severe headaches. And frankly, he was beginning to act in erratic and unusual ways. One of his closest friends at the time was a man named Larry Fuess. Larry reports this encounter during that summer of 1966. Quote, I walked into Charlie's one morning and he was packing his bags. He said he was going to leave everything. School, his wife, everything, and become a bum, end quote. Fuess was Charlie Whitman's very good friend. So he did what he thought was the right thing to do. He talked Charlie out of it. Don't leave your wife. Stay in school. You can get through this. I'm sure if Fuess had this to do all over again, he would have fully supported Charlie in escaping, going fugue. Pack your bags, get out. Don't shoot 45 people on campus in a few days. But Fuess did what he thought at the time was the right thing and talked Charlie down, talked him into staying with his wife, staying in school. This was just a few short weeks before Charlie's rampage. But people noticed a difference. After that encounter with Fuess, his friends noticed that he was no longer the happy Charlie that he used to be. Isn't that interesting? Everybody knew him as Happy Charlie, the scoutmaster, the ex-Marine, the student, the good friend. They had no idea what was happening inside of his mind. Sunday, July 31st had been one of the hottest days of 1966. Charlie and Kathy had been visiting with friends. They had to come home around 6 p.m. so that Kathy could go to work at her shift at 6:30. After Kathy left, Charlie Whitman sat down, took out a blank piece of paper, put it into his old portable typewriter, and began to type the following note. Sunday, July 31st, 1966, 6:45 p.m. I don't quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed. I don't really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable, and intelligent young man. However, lately, I can't recall when it started, I have been a victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. These thoughts constantly recur, and it requires a tremendous mental effort to concentrate on useful and progressive tasks. In March, when my parents made a physical break, I noticed a great deal of stress. I consulted a Dr. Cockrum at the University Health Center and asked him to recommend someone that I could consult with about some psychiatric disorders I felt I had. I talked with a doctor once and tried to convey to him my fears that I felt I had some overwhelming violent impulses. After one session, I never saw the doctor again, and since then, I've been fighting my mental turmoil alone and seemingly to no avail. After my death, I wish that an autopsy would be performed on me to see if there is any visible physical disorder. I have had some tremendous headaches in the past and have consumed 2 large bottles of Excedrin in the past 3 months. As he wrote those words, he was interrupted by a visit from his friend Larry Fuess and his wife Elaine. The Fuesses asked him what he was writing, and he replied, quote, "Letters to old friends," and he put the sheet away so they couldn't see it. Larry Fuess would later recall that Charlie was, quote, "in good spirits." It didn't seem like anything at all was bothering him. In fact, it was strange because he had a test the next day, and usually he was very tense before tests. Looking back, it seemed that he was particularly relieved about something, you know, as if you had solved a problem, end quote. Whitman and the Fuesses carried on a genial, amiable conversation that lasted about an hour. At one point, the conversation turned to the Vietnam War, which had just begun. Charlie Whitman said, quote, "I couldn't understand why boys from the United States had to go over there and die for something that they didn't have anything to do with," end quote. So certainly not uncommon sentiments from Charlie about the Vietnam War. So Charles Whitman and the Fuesses have this perfectly normal conversation that lasts about an hour. He's in no hurry. He doesn't rush them out the door, doesn't seem agitated, and then eventually the Fuesses leave. After they left, Charlie Whitman took out that same piece of paper, put it back in the typewriter, and continued along a much darker vein. He said this, quote, "It was after much thought that I decided to kill my wife, Kathy, tonight after I pick her up from work at the telephone company. I love her dearly, and she has been a fine wife to me as any man could ever hope to have. I cannot rationally pinpoint any specific reason for doing this. I don't know whether it is selfishness or if I don't want her to have to face the embarrassment my actions would surely cause her. At one time, though, the prominent reason in my mind is that I truly do not consider this world worth living in and am prepared to die. And I do not want to leave her to suffer alone in it. I intend to kill her as painlessly as possible. Similar reasons provoke me to take my mother's life also. I don't think the poor woman has ever enjoyed life as she is entitled to. She was a simple young woman who married a very possessive and dominating man. All my life as a boy until I ran away from home to join the Marine Corps." At this point, Charlie left his typing once again. It was about 10 p.m. at night. He had to drive into town to pick up Kathy from the Southwestern Bell telephone office where she worked. So Charlie drives into her office, picks her up, brings her home, and drops her off. After Charlie Whitman dropped his wife Kathy off at home, he went to visit his mother in her nearby apartment. Knocks on the door. His mother came to the door. Charlie Whitman waited for the door to close and then attacked her. His mother was found stabbed several times and shot in the back of her head. Charlie Whitman was large and strong, but his mother must have put up a fight because authorities say that several fingers on her left hand were broken, one so badly that her engagement ring was driven down into the bones of her finger. After doing this, he took time to write out a handwritten note and leave it with his mother. Authorities would find it the next day. It said, quote, "I've just killed my mother. If there's a heaven, she is going there. If there is not a heaven, she is out of her pain and misery. I love my mother with all my heart," end quote. Charlie then, in a cold, calculating manner, took time to pin the following note to the front of his mother's door. "Mother is ill and not able to come to work today." Then he drove home. When Charlie got home, his wife must have been asleep, because he went right to the typewriter. He appended the following note at 12:30 a.m. on the 1st of August, 1966. "Mother already dead." Then, sometime between 12:30 and 3 a.m., he went into Kathy's room where she was sleeping and stabbed her 3 times in the chest. Apparently, she was asleep when this happened. Charlie then took great care to wrap her neatly in a sheet and pull the blankets up around her. And then at 3 a.m., he added his final words to his what would become his suicide note. He wrote, "Both dead. I was a witness to her being beaten at least once a month. Then when she had taken enough, my father wanted to fight to keep her below her usual standard of living. I imagine it appears that I brutally killed both of my loved ones. I was only trying to do a quick, thorough job. If my life insurance policy is valid, please see that all the worthless checks I wrote this weekend are made good. Please pay off my debts. I am 25 years old and have been financially independent. Donate the rest anonymously to a mental health foundation. Maybe research can prevent further tragedies of this type. Charles J. Whitman. Then he appends a few afterthoughts. He says, give our dog to my in-laws, please. Tell them Kathy loves Scosi very much. He then goes on, if you can find it in yourself to grant my last wish, cremate me after the autopsy. And those are the last words that Charles Whitman wrote. At 5:45 a.m., he called his wife's supervisor at the telephone company, told her that Kathy was sick and wouldn't make it to her shift in the morning. Now let's just pause here for a moment to think about how methodical, how purposeful Charles Whitman was during these events. He was dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's, leaving a note for his mother's work, calling his wife's work, taking a long time at the typewriter to describe his motivations and actions, which he did in almost a ghoulishly calm voice. It certainly doesn't seem like the work of a madman. And he would continue to work very methodically throughout that day, 1 August 1966, after being up all night killing his wife and mother the night before. At 7:15 a.m., he drove to a rental equipment store and rented a three-wheel dolly. He then went to the bank and cashed two $125 checks, one from his own account and one from his mother's account. He took the money and went to the hardware store, Davis Hardware Store, and there he bought a World War II M1 rifle, 30 caliber. He then went to another gun store, Chuck's Gun Shop. He wrote a bad check from his own account and bought hundreds of rounds of ammunition. One of the clerks in the store remembers asking him at the time what all the ammunition was for, and Charlie said, quote, to shoot some pigs, end quote. The clerk at the time thought nothing of it, because apparently going out shooting wild pigs in Austin was a thing at the time. Who knows, maybe it is now too. Anyway, he didn't think anything of it. Charlie leaves at 9:30 a.m. He went to the Sears Roebuck department store in downtown Austin. There he bought a 12-gauge shotgun on credit, which of course would go bad. That's why he'd left that note, asking that all of his debts be paid off. And after buying the shotgun, he took a hacksaw, which I believe he had brought with him, and sawed off the barrel. So he had just made himself a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun. He then put it into his old Marine Corps footlocker, together with the M1 carbine he'd just bought, and all of the ammo and clips that he had bought as well. But he wasn't done yet. He then put into his footlocker a 6mm Remington bolt-action rifle with a 4-powered scope, a 35-caliber Remington pump rifle, 9mm Luger pistol, 25-caliber pistol, 357 Smith & Wesson Magnum revolver, and well over 500 additional rounds of ammunition. So we have three rifles, a shotgun sawed off, and three pistols, and now over 700 rounds of ammunition. It's interesting, he didn't even bring all of the guns he owned. He left two Derringers at home, because obviously they wouldn't work at long distance. In addition to the weapons, he packed a Bowie knife, machete, hatchet, two jerry cans, one filled with water and the other with petrol, matches, lighter fuel, adhesive tape, rope, a flashlight, a clock, a transistor radio, canned foods, including Spam and fruit cocktail, packet of raisins, and a bottle of deodorant, and a roll of toilet paper. We have no idea how long he thought this stand was going to last. He thought it would last long enough that he would need deodorant, food, water, and a roll of toilet paper. So thus, provisioned and armed, Charlie decided it was time to head to the campus. He got into his old Chevrolet and drove to the University of Texas. Now, the main building at the University of Texas, Austin, was the 307-foot-tall tower, which housed the library, administrative offices, and the Hogg Foundation. I kid you not, the Hogg Foundation, as in Boss Hogg from the Dukes of Hazzard, Hogg Foundation for Mental Health. And of course, as you remember, this is the self-same tower that Dr. Heatley, the staff psychiatrist at the University of Texas, wrote in his notes that Charlie was thinking about ascending and shooting people with a deer rifle. So August 1st, 1966, at about 11 a.m., it's already 90 degrees outside in Austin, Texas. Charlie gets out of his car in a white shirt, jeans, tennis shoes, all covered by a boiler suit, by a heavy pair of coveralls. Must have been nearly suffocating in the heat. Unloads all his gear and heads for the tower. He enters the tower, the main building, with all of his gear in his boiler suit, claiming to be a research equipment having to move equipment. When he gets to the main building, though, he realizes he can't call the elevator. Something's wrong. It doesn't work. A well-meaning receptionist, named Vera Palmer, sees that Charlie is struggling, comes over and helps him out by calling the elevator for him. Charlie says to Vera Palmer, quote, "Thank you, ma'am. You don't know how happy that makes me. You don't know how happy that makes me." And according to Vera, he repeated this several times as he got on the elevator. She thought that was a little strange, but in hindsight, it must have been very creepy. And she must have felt like an incredibly lucky person. Charlie then took the elevator to the 27th floor and dragged his gear off of it. That's the top floor the elevator served. He then had to haul his equipment up a flight of stairs to another hallway, and then finally one last flight of stairs to get to the observation tower. And it was there, after he had hauled his gear up that last flight of stairs, that he encountered the observation deck receptionist, the 51-year-old Edna Townsley. Townsley would be the first non-family victim of Charlie Whitman's rampage. She must have gone over to ask him what he was doing there with all of his gear, because that's when Charlie knocked her to the floor, smashed in the back of her head with his rifle, and then clubbed her under her left eye with his rifle butt one more time before dragging her behind a couch. And it was just after Charlie Whitman had dragged Edna Townsley behind the couch that two of the other luckiest human beings on the planet entered from the observation deck. Cheryl Botts and Don Walden had been looking off the observation deck. They entered the building and saw Charlie standing there with a rifle. This was Texas in 1966. You know what they said they thought? They thought that he was somebody who had come up to the roof to shoot pigeons. In other words, they didn't think anything of seeing this guy standing there with his rifle. Edna Townsley was hidden well behind the couch. Lucky for them, I must say. If they had seen her body there, there's no doubt that Charlie Whitman would have killed them also. But as it was, they said that he was cordial, said, "Hi, how are you doing?" They walked through the door and went back down the stairs to the elevator, not realizing until a few hours later how close they had come to being killed. After they went through the door that led from the lift, the elevator, to the observation deck, Whitman decided to barricade the door with a large desk. So he pushed a large desk in front of the door so that nobody could make their way onto the observation deck, at least not easily. Right around that time, the Gabor family was making their way to the observation deck, fully expecting to get a good view of Austin from atop the tower. And the Gabors comprised a fairly large family group. It was Mr. and Mrs. Gabor, their two teenage sons, Mike and Mark, and then a sister and brother-in-law. And of course, as soon as the group reaches the level where the observation deck is, they encounter the door that Charlie has barricaded. The two teenage boys get to the door first, try to push it open, and they realize that there's a desk behind it. Of course, they're not about to be dissuaded by a desk behind the door, so they decide to push and squeeze their way through the door anyway. When Charlie saw them coming, he lowered his sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun at them and pulled the trigger, firing twice. Mark, the 16-year-old, was shot in the head and killed instantly. Mike, the older of the two, the 19-year-old Air Force cadet, was hit in the shoulder. Both boys went down, but Mike would end up living, although his injuries would be severe enough that he had to drop out of the Air Force. Charlie, hearing more noise on the stairway behind the door, fired two shots with his sawed-off shotgun into the stairway. The two adult women in the group had gone ahead of their husbands, and they were hit by Charlie's shots. One of them was killed instantly. The other was left paralyzed from the neck down and legally blind. For some unknown reason, maybe she was starting to stir, Charlie went back and shot Edna Townsley in the head, the one that he had initially clubbed and dragged behind the couch. Charlie Whitman then left the hallway and went out onto the observation deck of the tower, and that's when he started taking pot shots at random passers-by. The observation deck goes all the way around the building, so you can see in every single direction around Austin from the observation deck of the tower. The first people to fall into Charlie's sights was a very young couple, Tom Ekman and Claire Wilson. Claire was pregnant with a child. Both of them were only 18 years old. Charlie shot Claire first, killing her baby instantly, and wounding her so badly that she was in the hospital for 3 months. Tom Ekman tried to comfort her, tried to figure out what was going on, and Charlie shot and killed him. Next, Charlie shot the mathematician Robert Hamilton Boyer, known for the Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, shot him in the lower back, and Boyer died sometime later. But Charlie moved on to his next victim immediately, shooting the 31-year-old PhD student Maitland Huffman. Huffman played it smart. He was wounded, badly wounded, but he lay on the ground pretending he was dead, and in that way survived the rest of the shootings. You can imagine that at these early stages, pandemonium reigned. Nobody really knew what was happening. A secretary named Charlotte Dereshery saw Huffman and Boyer go down. She ran to try to help them, and she herself came under fire. Somehow, though, the sharpshooter Charlie Whitman missed her, and she was able to take cover safely behind a large cement flagpole structure. She remained uninjured throughout the entire event. In fact, if you want to see Charlotte, look at timestamp 7:39 in the raw video footage that I appended in the show notes. You'll see Charlotte hiding behind the flagpole. In fact, at 7:57 in that same raw video footage, you'll see a man who was lying on the ground playing possum who gets up and runs for cover when rescuers come to get him. That man might be the PhD student Maitland Huffman, but I can't be sure. Whitman now took aim at four Peace Corps volunteers. The first one he hit was a man named David Matson. The bullet Charlie shot blew off half of Matson's wrist. Charlie shot another one of the Peace Corps volunteers right through the chest, killing him instantly. Two others were wounded as they ran out to try to help their friends. And so it went. Rescue workers, ambulance drivers, high school students, employees of the university, students of the university, even people from the town. In fact, Roy Del Schmidt was a 29-year-old electrician. He took cover 500 yards from the tower behind a car. After crouching behind the car for 30 full minutes with a few other people, he decided it was time to peek around and see what was going on. As he stood up to get a glimpse, he was shot and killed instantly, 500 yards away. A 24-year-old police officer, Billy Paul Speed, was standing behind some decorative masonry, thinking he was out of sight. Charlie spotted him between gaps in the masonry and shot him dead. A 35-year-old basketball coach, Billy Snowden, was getting his haircut at a barbershop well over 500 yards away. He heard what was going on, decided he was safely out of range, decided to go to the door and take a look, and got shot. Luckily, he was only wounded. And this went on and on. And to no one did the time pass more slowly than to some of the victims. Take the 30-year-old mortician, Morris Homan. He was shot in the leg while he was trying to use his hearse to carry victims to the hospital. He was wounded, and he lay on the ground in the street. He says, quote, "I recall laying there for about 40 to 45 minutes, listening to two construction workers arguing about who was going to expose themselves to recover me," end quote. Of course, by that time, Charlie wasn't the only one shooting. This was Texas, after all. So the police department, the sheriff's department, even the National Guard, concerned local citizens, were shooting back at Charlie in the tower. If you watch the raw footage of the time, or even the news reports from the event itself, you can see Charlie pop up and shoot, little puff of smoke coming from his rifle. But you can also see smoke from a hail of bullets hitting the tower near where Charlie is around the same time. In fact, at the time, they didn't have SWAT teams, so it was up to the local hunters with their scoped rifles, along with the National Guard and police, to pin Charlie down, to try to take him out. And by helping pin Charlie down, they probably saved many, many lives. It's interesting to note what was happening on the ground, on the other side, if you will. Well, remember we said that this was pretty much an incident without precedent. So some people thought it was an anti-war protest. They thought it was a theatrical troupe. People were acting. People were pretending to fall down. In fact, one victim recalled that as she lay bleeding on the ground, a student walking past her looked very angry at her, told her to get up. But some people did seem to realize what was happening. In fact, 4 minutes after the shooting began, the first call went into the police department. A history professor actually made the first call. So the police began to arrive while Charlie kept shooting. In fact, most of Charlie's victims died within the first 20 minutes of the shooting. Even as the police were desperately trying to establish a safe perimeter, Charlie was running around the tower, taking different positions, initially killing people on the South Mall, then people off to the west, to the north, to the east. After about 15 to 20 minutes, law enforcement began arriving en masse. City cops, highway patrolmen, Texas Rangers, even some U.S. Secret Service agents from Lyndon Johnson's Austin office converged on the tower. One patrolman, Ramiro Martinez, was at home cooking a steak when he heard a news flash on the radio, so he buckled on his pistol and rushed to the scene. The quick-thinking police department even sent up a light aircraft, police department marksman, Lieutenant Marion Lee, aboard to try to take out Charlie. And while this was happening, an armored car was being driven out onto the South Mall to try to save the victims. Really, when you look at the macabre novelty of the situation, how unprecedented this was, the police response was very effective. They saved hundreds of lives. Charlie had hundreds of rounds of ammo, and he was just going to keep shooting. In fact, he shot the police sharpshooter plane several times and forced it to retreat. He peppered the forces on the ground with fire and kept them pinned down. And trying to hit Charlie atop that tower was nearly impossible. It's almost as if the architect of that tower had set out to make a sniper's nest. Because not only was Charlie protected by the heavy stone parapet around the walkway, he also had gun ports in the form of drainage ducts that he could shoot through. And whenever he chose to, he could simply disappear behind the walls at the top of the tower. That made rushing the tower extremely dangerous, almost impossible. Not only did Charlie have an unobstructed view for yards and yards around, he could be anywhere. They wouldn't know where he was going to shoot from. Luckily, a few of the officers were extremely smart. They gained entry to the tower through underground conduits or by zigzagging between barriers. And that's how three policemen, including Ramiro Martinez, remember the off-duty policeman who had abandoned his steak dinner, three policemen and one civilian found themselves in the tower below Charlie. The civilian was a man named Alan Crum. He was a former Air Force tail gunner, and he was deputized on the spot. The other two police officers, besides Martinez, were Houston McCoy and Jerry Day. These four took the lift up to the 26th floor. Remember, the lift would go all the way to the 27th. But they didn't know what would be waiting for them on the 27th floor. Would Charles Whitman be waiting in ambush? Would he have set a trap? They decided to walk the extra flight and take the lift only to the 26th floor. As they walked the final staircase to the 27th floor, they came across the members of the Gabor family, some of them dead, some of them wounded, the remainder of them overcome with grief. So they left an officer there to help with the wounded, to tend to the family, while three of them continued. Martinez, McCoy, and Crum continued up the stairs to the observation deck. When they arrived to that final door, the desk was still behind the door, barricading it. This created a very dangerous situation for them. If Charlie was waiting, he could easily pick them off when they tried to move the desk out of the way. Luckily, at that point, spotters on the ground saw Charlie. They revealed his position to them, and they were able to very carefully and quietly move the door open just enough to squeeze through it. As they made their way out toward the walkway, they were advised by radio that Charlie was on the north side of the tower. So, keeping low, they crawled out onto the south side of the walkway and started making their way around the tower, with Martinez and McCoy turning to the east and Crum going around the west. Now, I know what you're thinking. If Charlie is in the center of the north side of the tower and you've got one side of the pincher movement, one law enforcement group coming from the east, the other coming from the west, not only will they be shooting at Charlie Whitman, they'll be shooting at each other. They could easily be hit by friendly fire. But the truth was, Charlie Whitman was supposed to be on the northeast side of the tower. That's why the two police officers exited through the south and went toward the east. They had essentially one corner to turn. If Whitman was where he was supposed to be, he'd be right there around that first corner. But what happened next is hard to parse out. As Crum was coming up on the north side of the tower from the west, he might have heard Charlie Whitman. He might have heard Charlie Whitman first. He heard what sounded like footsteps around the corner, running toward the corner. He didn't see anything, so sight unseen, he started blasting that side of the building, trying to dissuade Whitman from running around the corner and shooting him, most likely. Meanwhile, McCoy and Martinez were coming up from the east, so you've got this perfect square in the tower with a north, south, east, and west arm. Charlie Whitman's on the north arm. He's currently facing toward the west arm where Crum had recently shot. Whether or not Charlie Whitman had been moving or running, Crum thought he was and was shooting that way. This attracted Charlie Whitman's attention, so he was looking toward the west arm of the square. While Martinez and McCoy were coming up the east arm of the square, they peek around the corner and there, about 50 yards away, facing away from them, facing toward the west, was Charlie Whitman, now holding the M1 rifle, obviously waiting for Crum to come around the corner so he can kill him. Well, Officer Martinez was not about to let Charlie Whitman kill Crum. So he, I don't know if he even made a decision, he just pulled out his .38 service revolver and began blasting away. There are now two separate possibilities for what happened. The fact is, we don't really know who mortally wounded and who killed Charles Whitman. We do know that Officer Martinez fired off all six rounds from his .38 service revolver. According to Officer Martinez, quote, "He jerked. He couldn't keep his gun level. He kept trembling, going up instead of coming down with it. I don't know how many shots I fired," end quote. So by that description, you would think that Charlie Whitman was badly wounded after having been hit by at least some of the shots from that .38 revolver. We know then that Houston McCoy came around the back of Officer Martinez with a shotgun, leveled it, and blasted Charlie Whitman. According to Gary Laverne, author of the best-known book about the sniper in the tower, what happened was this. Martinez jumped out and fired at Whitman, all six shots, missing every single one of the shots. Officer McCoy came around the back of Martinez, leveled the shotgun, and fired as Charlie was looking over the top of a light ballast. Several of the BBs from that shot went right into Charlie's brain, and he was killed instantly. But McCoy fired again, this time hitting Whitman in his left side. At that point, it seems that Charlie Whitman was down and dead. But Officer Martinez was not satisfied. Maybe he was still mad about having to leave his steak dinner. He grabbed the shotgun from his ally, McCoy, charged at Whitman, shooting as he went. According to Officer Martinez explaining this action, quote, "That guy was still flopping, and he had that carbine in his hands, and I ran at him and shot at the same time. I got to him and saw that he was dead," end quote. At that point, people were still shooting at the tower. In fact, Martinez almost got shot by friendly fire. So Crum took a towel out of Whitman's footlocker, put it on a stick, and waved it to let everybody know the ordeal was over. The bottom line is, Charlie Whitman had tangled with a lawman named Houston McCoy. And if there's one moral, one take-home from this incident, it is that you don't tangle with a lawman named Houston McCoy. Whitman tried, and he got both barrels of a 12-gauge shotgun. The sniper in the tower, the whole incident, from the time the first shots were fired until Charlie Whitman died, was 96 minutes. Those of you with a morbidly curious turn of mind can look online and see the death photos of Charlie Whitman. The autopsy was performed, of course, according to Charlie's wishes. And as we have already alluded to, there was a pecan-sized tumor, or an astrocytoma on initial pathology, in the hypothalamus region. According to the pathologist who performed that autopsy, Coleman Deschanard, that astrocytoma could not have been the cause of Charlie Whitman's headaches and, quote, could not have had any influence on his psychic behavior, end quote. For whatever reason, according to the initial autopsy, Charlie Whitman's brain tumor was what a clinician would call an incidental finding, not relevant to why Charlie Whitman acted out the way he did. It is also true that they found several dexedrine tablets in Charlie Whitman's pocket, so it appears that Charlie Whitman was a tweaker. He was on amphetamines. But what was never established is that Charlie Whitman was on amphetamines at the time he ascended the tower and began shooting people. Maybe he was chasing Shadow Man or the Tree People. But the truth is, when you look at Charlie Whitman's study habits, he stayed up all night studying. And he wouldn't be the only student, then or now, to use amphetamines to help him do that. You remember when we started this episode, before I told this story in such grisly detail, we began talking about free will and whether or not the Charlie Whitman story helps us answer the question of whether there is such a thing as free will. If you listen to Sam Harris, another hard determinist, tell the tale, it seems pretty cut and dried. It's also simple. Charlie Whitman was the All-American boy, a great kid, the Eagle Scout, altar boy, pitcher for his high school team, popular kid in school, friendly and well-beloved by everyone, until, that is, he got a brain tumor. And then the brain tumor took over. It co-opted his free will and railroaded him into a series of disastrous choices, killing his wife and mother and shooting people from the tower. But now that you know a little bit more about Charlie Whitman's background, his history, and his family, that is altogether overly simplistic. And frankly, I'm not sure that we can take any kind of general conclusions about free will from the story of Charlie Whitman. All we can say is that in this one particular case, this psychotic, sadistic shooter might have been influenced somewhat by a brain tumor. And even that fact seems anything but well established. What we do know is that in his 25th year, Charlie Whitman began to complain of headaches, severe, persistent pain that he later described as tremendous. He wrote troubling journal entries, and the journal entries became more and more disturbing. He feared that his rage was getting out of control, that he might snap, and even went to a psychiatrist on campus and confessed that he had thought about ascending the tower and shooting people. We have to take his word for it that he was convinced something was wrong inside of his head, and that in his suicide note, he requested an autopsy because he was almost certain that they would find something wrong with him. I told you that the initial autopsy showed that he had an astrocytoma. Well, Texas Governor John Connally commissioned a panel of scientists to review those results, to go over the autopsy one more time. And this was a team of very heavy hitters, neurosurgeons, psychiatrists, pathologists, psychologists, and they decided after a long hearing that the initial autopsy reports had been in error. Contrary to Dr. Deschanard's findings, this was no astrocytoma, no benign tumor. This tumor had a very aggressive appearance, with areas of necrosis or cell death, palisading cells, and a huge amount of vascularity. In other words, this was a very destructive, rapidly growing tumor, the dreaded glioblastoma. And yes, in its location near the hypothalamus, it was most likely pressing on the amygdala, and therefore could have caused any number of alterations in his behavior and his thought process. This is why, like I said, Stuart Brown from Baylor said, quote, "The highly malignant brain tumor conceivably could have contributed to his inability to control his emotions and actions," end quote. And this is why Michael Koenigs, as we said, from the University of Wisconsin, an expert on brain lesions, said that Whitman's tumor had the potential to affect his mental state, saying, quote, "It could certainly affect his emotional state, and it could certainly affect his body's physiological responses to threat and healthy emotional responses related to aggression," end quote. And so, according to many hard determinists, the argument goes something like this. Charles Whitman was fairly normal until he developed a malignant brain tumor. As the tumor grew, his behavior became more erratic until he acted out in horrible ways. Ergo, Charles Whitman was truly not free. And QED, there was no free will involved in Charlie Whitman's actions. They then extend it with a major inductive leap to all of us. All of us are Charlie Whitman. Not in the sense that we're going to act out in horrible and uncontrollable ways, but in the sense that we too have determinants of our behavior. We have neurophysiologic, hereditary, environmental, and other forces at work that determine how we will respond to any situation. Our idea that we have free will is illusory. Now, I'm not going to try to determine if this argument is correct or not. I'm just going to say that, as presented, that is far too simplistic. Even in the case of Charles Whitman, it is not cut and dried. Listen to Professor Bradley Keel from Baylor College of Medicine. Quote, "Yes, he, Charles Whitman, had an aggressive malignant tumor in his temporal lobe that could have impacted his bizarre and violent behavior. However, what is often overlooked is that he came from a very abusive home and admitted to domestic violence with his own wife prior to stabbing her. I suspect his tumor was little more than circumstantial," end quote. Gary Laverne, the author of the book that I've mentioned previously called A Sniper in the Tower, written in 1997, said this about Charles Whitman. Quote, "For 48 hours, Whitman made several decisions in a correct order leading to the accomplishment of a goal. To me, his actions speak for themselves. If indeed a tumor or anything else took control of him and made him do something he didn't want to do, when exactly did this start?" End quote. Now, I have to say my bias is I agree with Laverne. He's right on the money here. If you have a tumor on your amygdala that is making you completely irrational, out of control, aggressive, and angry, are you really going to be able to sit down calmly and rationally and have a nice discussion with friends? Could a tumor exerting a little pressure on your amygdala do any more than what Michael Koenigs said? That is, tweak your personality a little bit, to be a little bit more aggressive or a bit less empathetic. I mean, the fact is that even Koenig, who's trying to lend some support to the idea that Charlie Whitman's actions might have been somewhat influenced by his tumor, doesn't even believe that it can explain them. The idea is absurd. A pecan-sized tumor near your amygdala turns you into a calculating, planning, cold, menacing, psychopathic killer. I'm sorry, that's not what broken amygdalas do. And that's not what functioning amygdalas prevent. If Charlie Whitman had suddenly started sucking on the barrel of all of his guns, that might be a little bit more relevant to his amygdala tumor. But the way that some hard determinists interpret this story, among them I include Sam Harris and Robert Sapolsky, is so transparently reductionist that frankly it smacks of a superstitious mystical brain power voodoo. It's like those stories where you get a heart transplant from a killer, so you become a killer. I totally understand that changing your brain changes who you are. What I am saying is that that tumor in Charlie Whitman's brain did not make Charlie Whitman everything that he was. And even if it did turn his dials from like 11 to 11 and a half, that really has very little to no bearing on the bigger question of whether we have free will. Genetics, our hormones, our environment, our experiences of the past, all of those things shape us and determine who we are. I still can't escape the fact that even acknowledging that in no way answers the question, the mystery, of whether or not we have free will.